Accession number 27226, reel 26.
Well, hook reel 26.
Okay. Right, so we've now got these aircraft all set up to go for a long, long run to Pelambang in Sumatra. They're fully loaded with petrol. They're about to take off. They could only carry as much as a swordfish, which is about a 500-pound bomb. And they were going to deliver it, I don't know how many miles, but I know that I went along that route later on in an Avenger. And they took off. They took off and got into the air, and they all went across that lake, leaving a wake behind them with the things. And that wake was still there when they got to the end. They just staggered into the air, so overloaded with fuel. And they set off. Within an hour, 26 of them had come back. So the rest had gone on their merry way. Of that 26 that came back, there was no service facilities there on the airfield at that time. They came back. They were checked over, but they had some mechanics about, but they had a group on board. We didn't know really about the logistics, but there weren't many people. They serviced the aircraft they could and set off and went back to central India. That was 20 or so of them back straight away out of 56, something like that. And they went off and all was quiet and peaceful. And we were waiting at the end of the runway for them to come back, and it was a 24-hour slot. The last one took 24 hours, which is part of the story. They kept coming back in ones and twos and threes, and we didn't know a great deal about what happened on that route. They just came. If they were in flying condition, they went to one of the upstands, filled it with fuel, took off again and went back to central India. No stop, no wait, no messing. The rest came back in dribs and drabs. And there was no nasties. They all came back, as far as I know. But one particular one had been in there for nearly 24 hours. And we were bringing him back from 400 miles out and listening to him all the time as he came in. And he gradually lost his engines one at a time. And we sent a walrus out to pick him up if he'd gone into the water. I think Jack was flying that. Oh, was it Jack? I think Jack was flying that. But anyway, no matter, because that incident nobody fell into the water. This last aircraft came back and he was losing his engines. We were listening to all this all the way back, and he came in on one over the harbour where the ships were, and as he was over the harbour, the engine stopped and he had no engines at all. He came in on a dead stick landing to the end of the runway, which was long, and at that time we were sitting at the end of the runway. Our encampment was at the end of the runway, and he came past us. And there was nothing at all in here. It was just rolling past, except there was a little petrol engine inside, which surprised us, that was still running to keep his electrics going inside the Super Fort. And that's all we heard as we went round to the end of the runway. Right. We've now got the end of the exercise. That was the excitement. And we know nothing really about what happened between there and then. They did no real damage to Pelambang at all. Nothing. Nothing worth talking about.
Can you give me a kind of thumbnail sketch of what the Super Fortress looked like?
It was a big aeroplane. We weren't allowed inside them at that time. Nobody would let us go inside. But they had a pressurised cabinet up front. That I do know, because I flew in one later on. Four engines. Big aeroplane, a big, very impressive aeroplane. Like the typical, it was just an upgraded four-engine aircraft, similar to the old Fortress, you know, the Fortress, but bigger, much bigger. I don't know what the engines were. I think they were probably Pratt & Whitney Double Wasp. I don't think it would be Wright Cyclones. But I couldn't say for certain anyway. But they certainly worked very well, because the ones that came back, they were okay.
Were they camouflaged at all, or did they have nose art or anything like that on them, did you notice?
No. They was in the normal format, if I remember right, they were silver. So there's nothing to disguise them. But the essence of America came when there were three aircraft left on the runway with the engines US, and they flew in two Curtiss Commandos aircraft from central India to service these aircraft with the crew, one of which was set up as a workshop and a library with all the books about the Superfort inside, and a workshop, and the other one had four engines in it. And they came into the place, they took the engines out. How the hell, I don't know how they took the engines out, but those engines were taken out of that aircraft, replaced into the other ones taken back, they were checked, the Curtiss Commandos flew back, those aircraft were serviced, and they flew back to Sydney. We never saw them again. The airfield, with all the petrol, the connections and everything else, was never used again for that purpose. It's just an incredible, and who knows about it? You know? Quite incredible. 3,700 yards concrete runway for super forts, with upstands for filling the things, petrol, a complete pipeline to the oil fuel depot for petrol for these blasted things. They went all the way there and didn't do any real damage at all. Now, later on, and it was, well, I've only got to China Bay, so I was at China Bay a long time. So it was the tail end of China Bay. Later on, the Indomitable, four carriers that were always in the harbour at China Bay, set off to join the Pacific Fleet, and they were the ones that did the Palang raid. On the way, just en passant, they went to Palembang, they dropped the bombs on it, they set fire to the whole place and took away 35% of all Japanese petrol supplies, four carriers. You know, they talk about economics, which are the better bet? While they were there, for those four carriers, before they set off to go to Palembang and onto the Pacific Fleet, they came all the way back to England, did the bombing. The same people who did the Palembang bombed the Tirpitz in harbour, and then came all the way back again. It's quite incredible.
So you said while you were there, you were doing all sorts of types of work.
Well, I was flying a fleet requirements unit, really, and I was an add-on. But what happened was I was only supposed to be there for, a month probably at the most, while we're waiting for a ship to get back home. But because there was traffic there all the time, I was offered an opportunity to fly back, and I turned it down. But it was flying back in a DC-3, and I wasn't very happy about that, and I thought I'd rather have a nice, quiet run. I don't know why. I could have got home much quicker, but I didn't. And strangely enough, my brother-in-law was actually flying those DC-3s, and he was coming out with VIPs and all sorts from the VIP flight, and it would have been all right.
Am I right, while you were at China Bay, there was an incident with the floating dock?
Oh, yes, but that comes in a second. We've dealt with the getting rid of all the all the bits and pieces, and you asked about what I was doing. Which, as I said, I was a dog's body, and I could fly all the aircraft they had. And so we did various exercises. I can only tell by looking at the log what they were. But one of the beauties that we did, mainly radar work for the Avengers at about 25,000 feet. And so, stop there. Yeah, one aspect of that was one of the jobs I did was flying Avengers. And they flew Avengers mainly because they were a good aircraft that go a long way. And I did radar checks for the fleet. And one particular check I did was for the Victorious. And the object of the exercise, and bear in mind, at that time, we're in the middle of the monsoon anyway, that I was instructed to fly at 25,000 feet, and I remember the course very well, 120, and go out at in the monsoon at 25, regardless of the cloud situation or anything else, for 2.25 hours and come back at no change in height, no, just a great distance. I think I had to go about 400 miles or so, 500 miles in an Avenger, which was fully loaded. And it was, that was just one, to me, you know, just the day-to-day work. It was flying an aeroplane, which I loved, flying conditions which were anything but pleasant, but happy. I had a navigator in the back. And we set off through the clouds and drummed on our merry way. And on the way back, I suddenly realised I'd been flying a long time. And I spoke to my observer in the back. I said, where are we? He said, oh, it's all right, no problem. He said, how far have I got to go? I said, oh, don't worry. He said, you're on the right course. I said, keep going. And he said, I'm reading a book, so forget it, you know, just keep going. He checked me so every so often, see which way we're going. And on the way back, it suddenly occurred to me that I'd gone about 400 or 500 miles in one engine, and there was nothing else but water there. No, there was nothing safety sent out for us. There might have been a submarine en route, but I never knew about it. I'd never been briefed on that one at all. And that if the engine had stopped, I would be very, very small, you know, like landing in the water between, without anybody really knowing where I was, unless I got a good radar fix. If you think about it. And I've continued to fly back, and there was, the trip was quite uneventful, really. We came back and landed, and the one thing I remember about it, that we did that for Victorious, and they never said thank you, and I'll never forgive them for that. But it's gone round, it's in the annals, I think, of the specific run. I nearly got to Singapore and back, and they never even told me that I was flying. Well, a lot of unfriendly people. And just to do a radar run, I did 400, 500 miles. It's down in the, it's down in the book there. So
when you do a run for them like that, what are they doing? What are they actually working on when you they collaborate?
They're trying to find to see if they could find an aircraft that far away. They're talking about 400 miles away, at 25,000 feet, because if they were in the Pacific in these conditions, the ultimate limit of the radar was important, because if they were going to be attacked by the Japanese there, they needed to know that they could pick up people quickly. Quite important in many ways, because radar developed from in those years I was flying for something that was stuck on the end of a swordfish to see if you could see something in the water, to a really sophisticated piece of kit.
And what was it like flying in the monsoon conditions?
Nasty. Because it was the instructions were flying straight and level on one course, one straight, and you couldn't do that at 25,000 feet, because there were cumulonimb either side of you going up to about 40, much higher than you, and thick and horrible, and you don't go through one of those. And you've heard a story about hitting one, haven't you? Haven't you really? No, I haven't told you that one. Oh, well, that is interesting, because I was aware of what could happen in a cumulonimb, because I was flying with a flight of 3 Hurricanes off the coast of East Africa, which I hadn't mentioned before, at about 20,000 feet. lovely, peaceful and quiet, a cloud in front of us, a top end of Cumnim. And it was straight in our line, and it was just a cloud, you know, top of a cloud, so just fly into it. So we flew into it at the top of a Cumnim, that would be about 25,000 feet. And we hit that Cumnim, and that was it. We lost it completely. It just took us, just split the three of us up. They were on the side, we were right at the top. You can imagine, take a pyramid, and we went right through the very peak of it, and thinking we'd just come out the other side. We lost all our secondary instruments straight away. We're straight away on primary, and we were in cloud, because it turned us over. We went into the cloud, going down. Jack and Shorty were on the side, and they got out very, very quickly. But I'd gone through this epicenter, an unusual and unique experience. I don't want to do it again either, because all I had was primary instruments, and in a situation where I didn't know what the aircraft was doing, and it was a series of very high speed spiral dives and half loops and everything else, when you were flying on your instruments all the time, and the instruments weren't really telling the truth. I suppose they were, but imagine a situation where you're looking at your airspeed indicator, and it's going up all the time, and your turn indicator's showing you're turning, and your speed's going up, but your altimeter isn't changing. You know, this is the sort of thing. Strange conditions in Cumnim, and I went in and out of that situation all the time, coming out to the bottom. It's an experience in flying that not many people will ever experience, to go all the way through. I'm just trying to think of what it did to instruments particularly, but you can imagine a situation where you're going down, your airspeed indicator shows you're going downward very fast, and your turning bank indicator isn't really giving you any indication that you're in a spiral dive. And I can't think of all the actual readings now on the dials, but to get out of a spiral dive at high speed, and you don't know that you're in a turn, you're going to give yourself up. You know, you're hauling back to try and gain height, and then all you're doing is tightening up a turn on the thing. And if you stall in those conditions, then you've got to recover, and then your primaries aren't doing very well. So it's seat of the planets flying, and you can't believe the seat of your planets when you're flying on instruments. And this went on and on, and I know that some of the situations must have been very, very, very hairy, but you didn't know, and you're sitting there with nothing but instruments, nothing but cloud all around you, in an aircraft that is out of control, because the natural elements can do more to the aircraft than you can do. So that can be lifting you up. The clouds can be lifting you up while you're trying to get down, and your altimeter is turning around and saying you're going up, or not reading properly, or with a lag. It was nasty. It really was. Very unpleasant. And I came out at the bottom at about 500 feet. And in rain, heavy rain conditions, and I set off to where I thought the base would be, and I came out from out of the cloud and out of the rain, nearly over the airfield. Quite unbelievable.
So by the time you were in monsoon conditions in Ceylon, you were avoiding...
Well, I was avoiding them. I was going between the clouds for all that I was... But then, from a radar point of view, from their point of view, it wouldn't have done them any good if I'd flown through those clouds, because I think the cloud effect would have been positive on there, whereas I was a chunk of metal that would be able to keep me if I was away from all the disturbance. So in my own interest, I was just moving around the tops of these things, but they were taller than I was. I mean, I was flying at 25, and these were probably going up to 40.
And what was the Avenger like to fly as an aircraft?
Well, I've heard stories about it. People said it was underpowered. But I remember I always flew it without a torpedo on. I flew it stripped. And it was a very, very overpowered aircraft when there was no weight in it at all. The extra engine. I mean, it took off on... To take it off, you wanted to open the throttle. When it went up in the air, it pulled itself up. It was a delight to fly, of course. It was sitting in an armchair, and the cockpit was very pleasant. But at 25,000 feet, it was hot. And that was one of the things I tell a lot of people about, because recently I had a cerebral hemorrhage, and I got away with that. And I think the reason was, but my blood connected, kept more oxygen than anything else. Because when I was tested, I told the test, didn't I? I went up to 30,000 feet without oxygen in a chamber. And whenever I was flying at 25,000 feet in the tropics, even in on long run particularly, where you're bored rotten, I trimmed the aircraft nose heavy, and I never had an oxygen mask on at 25,000 feet. On the basic principle that my recovery was quick, and if I trimmed it nose down, and I went unconscious with anoxia, by the time I came back to about 15,000 feet, I'd be awake again. And at least I didn't have to have the oxygen mask on my mouth, because it was hot and sweaty and you were breathing into it. And it didn't do the oxygen mask any good, because for your microphone was in there and you're breathing on the mic, and that could kill your mic as well. So practicalities took over, really, against my own better metabolism, and I never had any problems at all. Never had any problems.
You said it was comfortable to fly, but why was it so hot inside? Was there any way that you could have cooled?
I did open the hood normally. Imagine you're 25,000 feet in aircraft and you open the hood to try and keep it cooler, but it's still hot. You get the positive effect at a low. There's no air up there to take the heat away, really, and it cooks inside those things. It cooks.
Would you take in something like that when you were flying in the tropics?
Yeah.
Would you take water with you?
The answer to that is no. I don't remember. But again, things like that. Then we were never told about it, and. That's interesting, but
because I imagine you must have been quite fatigued and completely worn out if you've been flying for any length of time.
Yeah,
in that you know your body must have sweated out an awful lot.
Yeah, that's right. I never drank in an airplane. Never. No, that's true. I never. I suppose we're young and very fit. But, you know, it's amazing. I don't know anybody, and I get cramped now quite a lot. Flying Swordfish, where you probably couldn't get your trim right, and you were flying with a little bit of pressure with one leg on the thing, for 4.5 hours, which is a flight of an aircraft now. And we didn't get DVDs or anything like that. You know, it's you didn't know about them, of course. I knew about anoxia, because... I've been shown what would happen, and when you're amongst your peers there and they're watching you, and they saw what would happen, they said it was the most fantastic thing to see, because I was writing and I was still moving so slowly, so it was painful to watch, and then you just clamp an oxygen mask for face, and within a fraction of a second it was the writing was back again. So I'm lucky. And maybe, but that's a thought. I mean, on that, I don't remember feeling any discomfort. I mean, it's a long time back now, flying that long trip in an Avenger. I don't think of any. The only period of discomfort I ever really felt was when I wanted to pee in that Swordfish all those years ago. The rest of the time, I flew airplanes, I enjoyed it, I'd done flying. That probably made a difference.
And of course, a lot of the time that you had flown, I know you'd flown with the Swordfish with observers,
yeah.
But a lot of the rest of the time you'd flown singly, in a sense, and you'd done your own navigation. How much trust would you have to put into your observer on a long-distance flight like that? for your navigation?
Well, they did the work because they had a chart and they knew which direction you were going, so they'd record it all the time. But personally, whenever I had an observer in, I always had a pencil and I used to mark out on the my screen on the front of the thing my courses. And I once did the square search off Ceylon. I didn't mention that. Where we do is with somebody, an expediter or something, an American aircraft had gone into water, and we were trying to find it. And I was flying a Hellcat, I think, and doing a square search. And all I did was I knew the general wind direction. It was pretty regular there anyway. It was usually going in the same direction, the same speed, and I just drew a line for the wind. At the end of I used to draw my courses in a soft pencil on the top, just roughly back and forward, and when I got to the end I knew the wind was there, so I put that on and just drew a line, gave an approximate way back, and that was one way of navigating even on a long journey.
So with that you would also back up the observer's navigation with your own?
Well, I did that don't forget that when I was at Arbroath I was training observers. And you never knew where they were going to put you. I mean, they were not bad. They were good lads, really. But it's always nice to get, you know. And it was an insurance policy. It's easy to do because you've got a soft pencil and the screen over the thing is there, and you just draw the lines on it, you know, like this, and you know that line will be about that long. But at the end of the day, the product of all those various lines comes to a point at the end, and then you just say, well, I was there then and I was there to start with, and you draw a line from the two, and that's the way back home. And if you're pointing in the general direction, even if it's foggy or in cloud or anything like that, you're not going to be far away, and you know the speed you're doing. So it's the obvious thing to do. It just makes sense just to do it. And it was just a pencil, a piece of paper, well, not a piece of paper, a thing on the top, and that was it.
And how would you conduct the square search?
Well, we knew that the aircraft was in a certain position off Ceylon, so that was, as I say, in a Hellcat, it was a Wildcat, not a Hellcat, and I flew out to the point, and then to do a square search, you fly so far along in one direction and do a 90 degree turn to the next, and then do another 90 degree after done so long, and then another 90 degree back, so that you're actually starting a search to cover an area from a point by going round it in a series of squares, so that every turn you make, you're going further and further away, so you're covering a larger area looking for somebody. Bit hit and miss, but at the same time, from your point of view, you know that you've gone so that far, roughly, and then gone that far, roughly, and then because you're going past that way, you've gone that far. And it just comes together at the end, that by the time you've done a series of lines like this all over the place, and then you put a stop there, you know that you're going back in the right direction to get back home. That's all, really. But you have a fair idea of how long it's going to take and how far you are away.